The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, here we go, and it's Friday, and we're going to spend the first couple hours with Harry Cooper, who has spent more time unearthing real history in terms of World War II and thereafter than anyone I have ever met or ever heard about, frankly. There have been a lot of people who have written about World War II, few who have done the research, and no one who has done the amount of earth-shaking research that Harry Cooper has. It is still being talked about. The book, Hitler in Argentina, is shaking the history books, and hopefully will rewrite history into accord with the facts. We're going to do something different tonight. We're going to start out and do a little bit of a tour that he took, one of his patrols, with pictures. We're going to take you on a little picture tour, and then we're going to spend some time looking at new evidence and hear about the new data that has come to light even since the book Hitler in Argentina was published just a few months ago. So lots on tap. Harry, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Jeff?
Still here. Thank you, sir. And we have...
That's a good start.
That's a start. That's what it is. David D's art piece, the Georgia Guidestones up there for all of you to look at. I hope you know what they are. If you don't, you should take a look and do a little bit of reading and understand that the plan is there in black and white. If you go to the guest section, look under Harry Cooper's name. You'll find photos, Shark Hunter's Southern Patrols, and then newly discovered evidence of Argentina's connection with Germany in World War II. This is real history, the real deal, and we've got a lot to learn and a lot of things to see. So what have you been doing since we last talked? How is the book doing? I know it's selling well, but you've been on a number of radio programs. Bring us up to speed.
Right, yeah. I've been on quite a few radio programs. You opened the door for us, and boy, we sure appreciate that.
Of course.
We've been on, I can't even count how many, and I'm flying up to a film production facility in a couple of weeks, and we're going to do a DVD, which we will make available. That was your suggestion, that we do a DVD.
Very good.
And I've heard from the Travel Channel, they're going to fly me up to New York City and interview me for a program there.
Well, this is a big, big story, and it's time. And
yeah, it is a big story.
Yeah.
The sad thing is, some of the knotheads out in Hollywood, you know, they just brush it off. Oh, yeah, yeah, another Hitler, somebody saw Hitler in a 7-Eleven story.
With Elvis.
These guys got all the brains of a goldfish.
Well, they have a vested interest in keeping the lie going. They don't want to upset things. The only way you're going to get them to pay attention is if some of them get together and say, hey, there's a lot of money in this for us.
Yeah, I know. Money talks and you know what walks.
That's right. Well, if they decide they can make money with this story, they'll do it. And
yeah.
Maybe they will. They can paint him out.
Wake up to that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they'll paint him out to be some barbecuing children maniac in Argentina or something.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll get it right, at least in terms of getting him down there.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, we'll look at it. I don't give up real easy.
No, you don't. That's why we have what we have on tap tonight, and we have now real history, thank goodness, to you and to Shark Hunters. That's the story. Okay, we can look at Harry's name and look under that again. And if you click on Harry Cooper's name, you'll go right to sharkhunters.com. On the upper left, you'll see Fantastic Books of History. Click on that. It'll take you right to the book of the hour. In fact, the book of the year, in my view. Newly discovered evidence of Argentina's connection with Germany in World War II. We'll do that a little later. right under photos, Shark Hunters Southern Patrols. So let's click on that and load those pictures. Now, Harry takes trips. He takes people
right.
along, and these are always absolutely, they're life-changing, they're fascinating, they're unforgettable. So just give us a little thumbnail sketch about what the patrols are all about.
Sure. We go to historic places. We actually walk in the footsteps of history, and we meet the people who made this history. This is not just go to your local library and read a book. You're there. You meet the people who made the history, and well, some of them are gone now. Otto Kretschmer, the top submarine commander of the war, he came to almost all our gatherings over in Germany, came to the U.S. a couple times. Eric Topp, the guy who sank the first United States Navy warship by mistake.
By mistake, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it was an old four-stacker, and it was escorting a British convoy before the U.S. was in the war.
Uh-huh.
And it was a dark night. It was Halloween, in fact, 1941. Stormy, and at night, and all he could see was a British convoy with several four-stack destroyers like we had given to England. We gave England 50 four pipers, remember. He just assumed that was one of the ones, and he didn't know it was the USS Reuben James until after he had sunk it and the Mayday calls were going out. He thought he was going to be shot when he got back because all their U-boats were under strict orders from Hitler personally not to engage any American shipping, because he knew Churchill was trying to drag the U.S. into the war, and Roosevelt was looking for any excuse he could get. Fortunately for him, by the time he got back, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and so he was off the hook for that. But so many figures from World War II were there, and on the American side, too. Admiral Flucky, most highly decorated American submariner ever in history,
mm-hmm.
the Medal of Honor, four Navy crosses, etc.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been with us, yeah. Ned Beach, the guy who wrote Run Silent, Run Deep,
mm-hmm.
among other books, but that's his most famous one. He's been with us. And as we go through here, we'll see some other famous people.
Go ahead. We can start on any time on the Shark Hunters Southern Patrols, if you like, and just load those pictures
okay.
up, folks, and we'll...
Your listeners can go to sharkhunters.com and click on previous tours.
Oh, there's so many patrols, yeah.
How
many do you have up there?
Oh, my God, ever since 1987. One a year, sometimes two a year.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been to all sorts of great places. Started out in Key Largo, Florida. We go to Germany a lot, Russia several times. China, South Africa, way back years ago, but mostly Germany and Austria. And people can go with us, Shark Hunter members or not. For Shark Hunter members, save $200 per person, but that's all spelled out on the website. And they go down on the main page to Shark Hunter's Fantastic Patrols, click on that. And it tells about our Southern Patrol that's coming up this September. The high point of the Southern Patrol is always the memorial meeting at Ulrichsberg, Ulrich Mountain, in which the German veterans memorialize everyone who fell in battle, no matter what uniform they were wearing. And we're always guests of honor there, as we'll see in some of those photos later.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead.
And they say, and truthfully so, you cannot take a bad photograph, you cannot get a bad meal, and you cannot get a bad beer in these areas. the first photo there, number one, that big marble facade.
We'll go through the break, Todd. Yeah.
Say again?
I was telling Todd, we're going to go through the break the first 2 hours here, the first break. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Anyhow, photo number one, that marble building. You've probably seen the movie Triumph of the Will, and you see that big ceremony where Hitler comes down off his podium And he and Himmler and Rome at the time marched through the tens of thousands of troops standing at attention to the other end of Zeppelinfeld for the death ceremony. In other words, remembering the fallen soldiers. And this is where they would light the big, huge braziers with all the flags and the fanfare and everything all about it. And we go there every year. We go many places in Nuremberg, some places where it says Eingangverboten, which we know means shark hunters only are welcome here.
Exactly.
Yeah, one of our members, who's also a good friend, is the assistant to the Lord Mayor of Nuremberg, and he's got the keys to everything.
Yeah, it also means lockpicking allowed when necessary, doesn't it?
Only when I'm off in the woods to where nobody can watch me pick locks. But that's another story. Photo number two, that big red building, that's the Congress Hall, which was built like the Colosseum in Rome, only you could fit the Colosseum inside this structure. It was going to be for all the offices of all the important people from the Reich, and they just never finished it. At the end of the war, the last 6, 8, 10 months of the war, it was a field hospital. And unfortunately, when the war ended and everybody surrendered, the U.S. Army took over that area, and they found there were 17 wounded soldiers who were Waffen-SS, and they just dragged them out in the courtyard you're seeing here and shot them dead. And I guess that was trial by M1 rifle.
Well, trial by inhuman behavior.
Yeah.
This is a picture number
two. No,
well,
number two is that
you
facility.
I want to go again back to the old saw we visit and revisit. It is true. It is not a myth. That the German military, now there were exceptions, by and large, had more dignity, more class,
honor,
and more tradition than any other soldier in World War II. They had a history of honor that the others didn't understand. They just didn't
right.
want to hear about it. The Russians were just Soviets at the time, were forced in unbelievable human wave assaults into pure death, and behind them were commissars with submachine guns, and if they hesitated, they were shot in the back, and the Germans simply could not kill them fast enough. That's really what the simple story of World War II in the East was. 90% of the German military fought in the East. Their machine gun barrels would melt, I guess. That's what I hear. The Germans.
Well, he'd up to where the gun would jam.
Yeah. Yeah.
The American soldiers I've talked to that fought against the Waffen-SS have nothing but praise for those guys. They were the toughest soldiers there were. They were the Green Berets of their day.
Uh-huh.
And another fellow, I don't have a photo of him here, but he joins us. His name is Manfred Thorn. He was with Piper, Joachim Piper, at the Malmedy situation, and he set us straight on that. You know, people think, okay, Malmedy, here's a bunch of German soldiers, killed a bunch of American soldiers. No, the line of march, Manfred said, was 20 miles long. So what was happening at this little section, the rest of the group didn't know anything about it. He had to stand trial after the war was over for the Malmedy situation, and he was found not guilty of any wrongdoing. And he always joins us. He speaks fairly good English. His wife speaks perfect English because she was born and raised in England, and she married Manfred.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have a lot of Waffen-SS guys show up at this event. One of them is a good friend of mine, Paul Roche. This guy is 95 now, and I was over to see him. He was a tank commander in the 5th SS, the Viking Division. And when I was over to visit him a couple of years ago about Christmas time, we were going around the town square in what they call Weihnachtsfest, Christmas festival. I had to run to keep up with this guy. I'm in really great shape, but this old guy, he was about 91 at the time, I guess. He was just walking, and I had to run to keep up with him. A decent, honest guy. And they live long, and they got a lot of stories to tell.
Yeah. Well, good. Very good. Okay. We're looking at photos, which, again, are centered in what location?
These right now are Nuremberg.
Okay, in Nuremberg. All right. We're looking at picture number three.
Some of the veterans that come out, the gentleman on the far left there, mm-hmm. he was with the Prince Eugen Division. And the lady on my left, which is the photo right, the lady with the white blouse on, she was at the 1936 or 34, anyhow, the big party convention. And she was selling sausages.
Wow.
And when she was all done, she was walking down the road, and Hermann Göring came by in his limousine, and he offered her a ride. She was so excited. Göring offered her a ride in his limo. She never said if he bought any sausages.
Uh-huh. Oh, very nice. Is she still with us?
No, she died last year.
Mm-hmm.
Nice lady. Spoke enough English to where we could converse, because my German's a little bit rough.
Mm-hmm.
Next photo, they're number four. If anybody are NFL fans, that huge guy there playing with the machine gun was a linebacker for the Steelers just before the famous Steel Curtain linebackers came in. He was just retiring about the time Jack Lambert and Jack Ham.
Look at those arms. Well, you can tell.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. He's 75 now, and he holds some kind of Florida and national record for bench pressing for guys over 65. The guy's
mm-hmm.
huge.
Yeah.
This is a very special museum. Our friend, who's the assistant to the mayor, has a museum, and it's only open to friends. And he's got stuff from the Franco-Prussian War all the way up to World War II in there. And we come across items that we donate to him every so often, and well-maintained, and we always leave him a few bucks in his tip jar so that he continues with the work he's doing. Guys just bends over backwards for us, and he's one tough guy. He's a battalion commander now with the German Army, the colonel, and he's been in combat in Bosnia and Afghanistan several times. And he drives around in a World War II Kubelwagen.
No, it's still, huh?
Yeah.
Fun. Good for him.
Although he can't have the swastika on the side anymore. They frown on that over there.
Can he have an Iron Cross?
Yeah, he's got the Black Cross on it.
So that's basically, they call it the thing now, and they reproduced them, right?
That's correct, yeah. They reproduced them for a while, and then some do-gooder said, hey, wait a minute, Germany's not allowed to produce military weapons anymore, military equipment, and that
please.
Was a staff car.
They're,
yeah, so
they're, by the way, they are kind of prized over here, and they're all, when they're around, they're restored. There are a lot of them. They're called the VW thing.
Right, and they're worth a bunch of money if you get them in good condition.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're worth restoring, that's for sure.
Yeah, not quite like a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air convertible,
no,
which is worth about $100,000. But
yeah, there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
In fact, if you just type in a search VW thing, you'll see a whole lot of them. And were they virtually identical? Were they the same? As
the same thing. That's the same thing. A Kubelwagen and the thing. It's the same thing. They just kept on making them. The only variant they had was the Schwimmwagen, which was modified, and we saw one when we were over there a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of like a thing, but it's got a propeller in the back and a power takeoff, and you drive this thing into the water and crank on the power takeoff, and away you go.
I think I've seen one of those.
Yeah, wow. Those are incredibly rare.
Yeah. Okay.
On to number five. Number five, that's the dragon, the Lindwurm, as it's called, in the town of Klagenfurt in southern Austria. That's the county seat more or less. And that dragon is made out of stone, but according to the locals, back in medieval days, that dragon was real. It was alive. It roamed all through Europe, but the thing could only eat virgins, and when it got to Klagenfurt, the poor thing starved to death.
It did. That's the legend.
That's the legend.
Why did it starve to death? Because there were no virgins left?
That's pretty much the conclusion you draw, right?
I see.
And they say now if a virgin was to walk past, the tail would wag, and they said nobody has seen the tail wag
in 50 years.
That's the emblem of the city of Klagenfurt, and that's in the town park. And it's a beautiful town, and they've got incredible pastries over there. And we spend a day in Klagenfurt, souvenir shopping. We're sitting around at sidewalk cafes, eating great pastry and have nice tea, and just watching the people go by. That's
very
still all
nice.
Part of our Southern Patrol, right? Then you look at photo number six, and this is where veterans meet and exchange ideas. The big guy with the red sleeves, he's a Shark Hunters member, and he's a good friend of mine now over the years. He was a combat U.S. Marine during Vietnam, 250 sorties to go out after Charlie. And the guy he's with was a machine gunner from the Waffen-SS. And so the two of them spent hours talking about their experiences in the war.
Yeah, I bet. All right, so this first page of photos are patrol pictures. We want to get through those so we can get to pages 2 and 3. So we'll come right back in a minute and keep moving ahead with Harry Cooper as we take you on a visual tour of a patrol to Germany. Okay, and we're back with Harry. Just look under Harry Cooper's name, photos, first group. That's where we are, Shark Hunters Southern Patrols. And we are at picture number... Number seven. Get my screen to move here. There it is. Okay, picture number seven.
Okay,
and,
as I say, the famous people, you know, famous veterans.
Sure.
The big guy on the left in the picture, he was the skipper of USS Queenfish, the nuclear boat, when they did the same thing as USS Halibut, tippy-toeing along on the bottom up off the northern coast of Russia, tapping into the Russian communication lines.
How did they do that? They didn't get out of the boat and go and put a splice in there.
I don't know, and they're not talking either. It was fairly shallow water, though, but he wrote a book about it. I can't remember the name of the book. But he's got a Ph.D. He's a retired U.S. Navy captain, graduate of Annapolis, president emeritus of the Explorers Club in New York. Guy's a busy fellow. But he has, he's been a member of Shark Hunters 10 years at least. So I'll move it along a little faster because I think you're trying to move me along. Okay, photo number eight. Another veteran and his wife. Number nine, that's the memorial service. They post the colors, not the flag that'll get them into trouble, but the regional flags, etc.
And this is all in Nuremberg.
No, this is all in southern Austria.
Okay, we're in Austria now. All right.
Where that dragon was.
Yeah. Okay.
And now we switch to number 10. That's in the beautiful little village of Berchtesgaden.
Oh, yeah.
That is the tombstone of a guy named Dietrich Eckhart. He's the one that founded the NSDAP, which some people call Nazi Party.
Yeah,
he founded it. It wasn't Adolf Hitler.
National Socialist.
Right. He's buried right there in the main cemetery within 5 feet of the main gate. Photo 11. That is the escape door for Adolf Hitler's air raid bunker. It's locked, of course.
At Berchtesgaden?
at Berchtesgaden, yes. Mm-hmm. It's on the mountain called the Obersalzberg.
Mm-hmm.
And it's locked because if you get in there, of course, your brain will melt and you'll become a Nazi. That's the way the government looks at it.
Absolutely. Yeah,
shame on us. Number 12, that is the entrance to the Eagle's Nest, which is really called the Kelstein House because it's the house on Kelstein Mountain.
Now, that's still intact, isn't it?
That is still exactly the way it was.
So they drove in there. That's an underground entrance, and there was obviously a garage or something. And look at picture number 13. Go ahead.
Yeah, number 13. Actually, after you go down number 12, you get down through that tunnel, which now is walking, and you go into the beautiful copper-lined or brass-lined elevator, the same elevator that Hitler and Bormann
We've seen rode. That in earlier programs. It's beautiful.
Right. And we go up in it, and we wind up, as you see up there, number 13, that's the Eagle's Nest. It was not destroyed. After the U.S. left Bavaria and gave that area back to the Bavarian government, they couldn't trip over themselves fast enough to destroy everything that had to do with the Third Reich. Except this, even though it was built by Martin Bormann for Hitler's 50th birthday, they decided it was not Nazi. Why? Because they make such an incredible amount of money. Mm-hmm. We figure they clear a good $10,000 a day with all the people going there buying souvenirs, buying lunch. It's a beautiful place, and you've got a view. You can actually see the castle of Salzburg there, and that's 20 miles away.
How much was Hitler and Eva Braun and the others, how often were they up at the Eagle's Nest? Now, his residence was lower on the mountain, of course.
Yeah, his residence was on the other mountain, was on the Obersalzberg.
Mm-hmm.
This is on Kelstein, which is the next mountain over. By some accounts, he was only there two or three times, and they didn't like it. By other accounts, he loved it, and he was there many, many times. Eva Braun had her own room in the lower level where she and the girls would get together for lunch because they weren't allowed to be up in the main room with Hitler and all the important people. There was also a room down in the second level for the guards and the chauffeurs, etc., where they had their meals. But it's, like I say, it's run by the Hofbrauhaus, and it's making money hand over fist, so it's not Nazi. Funny how those things work, you know?
It is.
So we'll jump to the next picture, 14.
Uh-huh.
That is the entrance to the world-famous Oktoberfest, the world's biggest beer party.
And where everybody walks in and most of them are carried out.
Yeah. It was originally designed for the wedding feast of Prince Ludwig II, who later became King Ludwig, who was called Mad Ludwig because he was building so many castles and bankrupted the kingdom, and they ultimately found him floating face down on the local lake there, Kimsey.
Hmm.
And but now it is to showcase the Munich brewed beers. Only the Munich beers are there, and I have to chuckle at the places here in the U.S. that have Oktoberfest in October, because it isn't in October, it's in September, the last 2 weeks in September. They originally had it in October, I guess, but the weather's starting to get crummy, so they shifted it forward a little bit.
That damn global warming early, I know.
That's what it is, yeah, global warming centuries ago. Excuse me, I guess I should say decades ago. Number 15 and number 16 are just us enjoying Oktoberfest, and it is a lot of fun. It's a great time. Each one of the huge, big beer tents has its own oompah band, and each one tries to outdo the guy in the tent next to him. And it's just a whole lot of fun. A lot of people having a good time.
Nice.
And drinking a whole lot of beer and eating radishes and whatever else, pretzels, and those gorgeous girls with the big boobs carrying 6 or 8 giant mugs of beer at a time. And I guess you're supposed to grab their butt as they go by.
Is that tradition, or was that just something that intoxication brings on?
I don't know, but I figure if I grab somebody's butt like that, I'll wear 8 glasses of beer. And
yeah.
So I just watch them go by.
Well, okay. All right, that's our tour, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, that was the tour.
That was fun. And that's just a tiny little percentage of what goes on there.
That's extraordinary.
Okay, be right back, and we'll go down to Argentina next with the next group of pictures under photos. And new information has come to light since the book Hitler in Argentina was published by Harry Cooper several months ago. So stand by. We'll be right back. Okay, back with Harry. And if we go down to the group of photos, newly discovered evidence of Argentina connection with Germany in World War II. I'll click on that, load that page, a couple of pages, and we'll start to meander through those. Now, these pictures were taken when, Harry? When did you actually capture them?
Some of these pictures have just been dug out of files. Other photos have been taken within the last 6 months.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
Starting,
here we go.
Yes.
Newly discovered evidence of Argentina's connection with Germany in World War II by Harry Sharkhunters.com, Harry Cooper, 5/23/14. That's today's date. Some of these pictures are old, some are new. And, okay, here we go. Let's go.
All right. Photo one. That's a glider in Argentina, but it's a German-built glider. And you switch to photo number two, you're absolutely certain it's a German-built glider because it's got a big swastika flag hanging on it.
Is that a Horton Brothers design? Do we know?
No. The Horton Brothers had designed flying wings,
yeah,
and the Argentine Air Force had been using them in the late 50s, I think it was. But they were primarily for transport.
Mm-hmm.
It, honest to God, it looked like a giant flying wing with a Winnebago camper hung underneath it.
Mm-hmm. We've seen a picture of that, too. Yeah.
You're right. Right. There's a lot more story behind these photos that we haven't really dug out yet. One of my guys down there in Argentina just dug these photos out and is digging into the wherewithal again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm possibly going down there in July just myself. To dig further into this. I'll be taking a group down in January, so anybody who wants information about that, just send me an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and within about 2 or 3 weeks, we'll have the details up on the website. And we'll go to the home where Hitler had lived from 1955 until 1965. We'll go
you
to
mean,
the hotels.
You mean 45 to 55?
Yeah, 1945 to 1955.
You said 55 to 65, okay.
Oh, okay, sorry. Alzheimer's creeping up on me.
If you want to know anything else about Hitler in Argentina, just ask.
Okay.
This is the Mercedes-built home on the lake at Bariloche,
right,
which is stunning. Is that same boat driver still around, the boat captain that took you out there, do you think?
We're trying to find him. I don't think we'll have any trouble finding him, but it wasn't that we had a name and a phone number and everything. We tracked him down through various people, and we know where he keeps his boat, so we'll just go knock on his door and say, hey, remember us?
I really hope you can get sit him down and get a long story out of him on video.
He grew up on that place because his dad was the caretaker, and he was goose-stepping with his right arm in the air, joking around, and he said he knew who lived there because he grew up there. So,
there's a story. That's a very big part of the story.
Our tour will be there. We'll see the home where Hitler lived from 1945 to 55, and then he moved up to Cordoba province where...
We don't know where he lived up there, do we?
Now, we've got a rough idea, but we got to narrow it down.
Okay.
And we found an interview that was done by a friend of mine down there, a guy named Abel Basti, who in my opinion is the number one researcher of the Germans who from South America. And he interviewed this tradesman who was working for what was it? Ante Pavlik, the head of the Croatian fascists. And when when everything collapsed in Europe, Antipavlik went to South America, to Argentina, and he ultimately became a general contractor, owned a big contracting company, built a lot of the big buildings in Buenos Aires and also in the seaside town of Mar del Plata. And this guy saw Hitler come and talk to Antipavlik on three separate occasions in Mar del Plata. And I think, yeah, we've got that interview in Hitler in Argentina in that book.
I really hope. I think, honestly, the guy with the boat is the key to a whole new wave of information. If he can just sit down and tell the story in detail, this will be fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. The clock is ticking, and people are dying.
Well, he's not that old. I mean, he's what, 70s?
Well, he was about 60 at the time, and that was in 2010, so 4 years ago. So he was about 60, 65.
He's fine. Get him.
okay.
Go get him, Harry.
We'll work on that.
All right. This just drives me nutty. I wish I could go down there with you and help.
Well, I wish I could speak Spanish a little better. In June, I have a meeting with one of our angels, a guy who is incredibly wealthy. And every so often he'll pop a few grand to send me down and
He is, bless him, because this is the most crucial historical work of modern history that can be done.
Right. Yeah. You can help support him too, just buy Entenmann's cupcakes and Entenmann's cookies.
They're too good. Sorry.
Yeah. So anyhow, we look at photo 3. This is a, or better choice of terms for brevity, we'll call it a Nazi rally. You see the picture I'm talking about?
I certainly do.
Yeah, with the big swastika flag and off to the left a little bit of picture of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. Sure.
This was a rally put on by a guy named Alfred Bühler.
What year approximately?
This was in the late 30s.
Okay, so this is, again, to underscore the fact that the National Socialists in Germany had a tremendous alliance and allegiance from people in Argentina who were also of that same general philosophy.
Right. Yeah, in a previous broadcast, you and I talked about the Luna Park in Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
And they had 40 or 50,000 people in there for the Nazi rallies, and Mueller was part of the organizers.
Well, we used to have similar crowds, even bigger crowds over here before the war in 1939-40 with Lindbergh speaking and others, the American Bund. Nobody wanted anything to do with a war in Europe here. Nobody.
That's true. That's
virtually
true.
Nobody.
Gary Cooper was another one who was against the war.
That's right.
And but didn't matter. Churchill needed it, and Roosevelt was his puppy, and away we went. Anyhow, after I said that in a previous broadcast of yours, somebody sent me an email. You speak so badly about Churchill.
Well, Churchill, you know? I'm sorry. Let me speak badly about him. He was a deviant. He was a degenerate. He had gone broke twice. Bernard Baruch, one of the most wealthy men of the last century, bailed him out and thereby owned his fat ass completely. He was a butcher. He authorized Bomber Harris to kill Americans and mostly Germans, of course, with his bombing raids. Some Americans, prisoners of war, I guess, were killed. But the point is, they bombed Germany's civilians for years. They didn't bomb military targets. They couldn't hit them. They were underground. They were hidden away. There were some Schweinfurt, yes, the ball bearing works and all that. But this was a war of genocide. Hitler was not a genocidal maniac. Churchill was. Okay? The total number of people killed in all the German raids on Britain in World War II, I believe, was about 50,000. Lamented. I'm sorry about that. We had 50,000 a night killed in bombing raids over Germany for years.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. It just doesn't, you know, you got to equalize things and look at them honestly. Churchill was a fraud. Sorry. The only good thing Churchill ever did was in his biography, in between fifths of scotch, admitted that the war was not ever being fought against Adolf Hitler or the National Socialists. It was a war being fought against Germany because Germany had to be destroyed because it was taking over the world through its industrial, artistic, and the arts, the sciences, everything. It was just leaving everybody behind.
Well, okay. Tell us how you really feel about him.
All right. Someday I will.
No, you're right. He was not the wonderful guy that everybody says he was. Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt
presided over a communist regime in this country, which was sending nonstop to the Soviets our top secret materials, including bomb-making materials, plans, blueprints, the whole thing. And this is all easily findable. Just read Major Jordan's diaries. It's on the net.
Okay.
Major Jordan's diaries, about 100 pages. It's his testimony to Congress, the truth about us flying our top secrets to the Soviets throughout the war.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, we also have to keep in mind that one of our members, very, very respected researcher, writer by the name of Charles Higham, who's a transplanted Brit, lived out in Los Angeles.
Lived in Hollywood, basically.
Yeah, right. 4027 Farmouth Street, I remember. It sticks in my head.
Mm-hmm.
He was digging into the story of Rudolf Hess, and he had all the proof he needed to prove that Hess was on a peace mission. He was supposed to parachute onto the estate of the Duke of some such thing or another, who was a cousin to the king, because Churchill kept stifling all the peace proposals. But the Churchill government found out about this and grabbed him and stuck him in the slammer. We all know that story. Well, when I last talked to Charles Higham some time ago, he told me a lot of the things he had found and he was about to put into his book. And suddenly one morning he woke up dead, and all his papers are gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hate it when you wake up dead.
That's not a good way to start the day. All right, hold on. We have to pause here for a few minutes.
Okay.
We'll be back with the remarkable Harry Cooper as we continue our photo tour of new information from Argentina. Next. Okay, hour number two, here we go. Let's get ready to have some more historical fun and fascinating pictures with Harry Cooper. All right, we're looking at the Argentina pictures, and we're at number four, I believe.
Okay, we just left number three. I had one more little bit about that guy, Alfred Mueller, who had that rally. He had a lot of rallies. He came to Buenos Aires on the 2nd of April, 1924, when he was 20 years old. Then on the 5th of April, 1939, he was leading a big parade of about 2,000 people when the police broke up his parade. But he continued to agitate or lead or whatever quietly. And if you look on photo four, that's a restaurant where he would hold his meetings with the swastika flag on the left and the Argentine flag on the right. And if that restaurant looks a little familiar, that's one that I showed on your program a couple of programs ago, a photo I took. It's in the ABC restaurant, which is still in operation in Buenos Aires. That's where Mengele and Eichmann used to meet for lunch, and so did a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
So one wonders,
Bariloche, if Hitler did any socializing at all, if he would make an appearance at his birthday dinners that they used to hold for him every year.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have an answer to that yet, but we're digging.
I know you are.
We're digging. I love tackling questions with no answers because there got to be an answer somewhere.
Got to be.
Yeah. So we go to number five, and that's a map we just found, showed the position of a German bunker in Buenos Aires. I don't know what's there now, but I haven't.
You mean an underground bunker?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having one of my guys go back and check it out and see the location, the area, and then if I go down there in July, I'll go there. If not, I'm going in January for sure. And we'll find out what's there.
Okay, well, let me know. We'll see some pictures, hopefully, on this program.
Oh, yeah, you betcha. Count on that. The next batch, photo number, what the heck is that? Number six, I guess it is.
Yes.
Yeah, there we go, number six. The headline is, I can't read it anyhow, but it's the German army in Argentina.
Now these are Germans or are they Argentines?
The headline that I've got here says, Here in Argentina.
Did they go to serve in Europe, any of them? Do we know?
I don't know. I don't think so, but I don't know for sure. Argentina was staying staunchly neutral on paper, but they were helping the Germans. They were very pro-German, and they only declared war against Germany in March of 1945, just a couple of weeks before the capitulation.
Right.
And they only declared war on paper just to keep the U.S. off their back. You remember the movie I told you about that Disney came out and called Three Amigos, in which they had Donald Duck and Goofy and a brightly colored parrot named Jose Karaoke. And they were showing how North America and South America were best buddies, and they were going to fight together against the evil Nazis and the Japanese and all that. So Argentina only declared war on paper. As we're finding out now, they were awfully friendly to the Germans after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was the army in Argentina. There were army advisors, and I suspect that's what that is.
Okay. All right, very good.
Now the number seven.
The next
one.
Now it's number seven.
Yep.
Is that a Yunkers?
It is indeed. Alte Tante U, old Aunt Yunkers.
Yeah, they took that somehow to Argentina.
Yeah, 1938. That's 38 or 39. I can't read the inscription, but that thing didn't make it there on its own wings. It didn't have that kind of range.
I think it's 38. Yeah.
Okay. I rode in one of those things about 15 or 20 years ago.
Lufthansa
bought one. Right, and refurbished it into a 1936 airliner,
uh-huh.
And they were doing VIP tours all around the U.S., and they invited me to fly on it.
That must have been amazing.
An interesting plane.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You just let your mind wander back to the 30s,
mm-hmm.
And it was hotter than hell, though, because that's an all-metal airplane and under the hot Florida sun. And the fumes from the middle engine come back into the cabin. And every time I'd open the window, the steward is running over and shut the window. It wasn't a lot of
You fun. Had windows that you could open up. That thing must have done about 120 miles an hour then.
Oh, yeah, and it never went over about 2,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. You actually could open up the passenger windows in an airplane.
Oh, yeah.
See, that's amazing.
Well, it wasn't meant for supersonic flight or whatever.
Of course not, of course.
And like I said, never flew above 2,000 feet or so. I'm sure they could go higher than that. But the one I was on flew between 1,000 and 2,000 feet. We flew for about an hour out of Tallahassee, flew a big circle around the area for about an hour,
mm-hmm.
And came back and landed again at Tallahassee. It was a heck of a nice airplane. It didn't go very fast, like you said, about 120 knots. But that got where you were going.
Yeah, sure.
They use it for the paratroopers over Crete, the Fallschirmjägers.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It was quite a durable plane.
It was a tough airplane, akin to our DC-3, I think.
Same idea.
It was also a tough airplane. You could open the windows in the DC-3 too, not in the cabin area, but the pilots could open them outside.
The DC-3 probably was, pound for pound, the best airplane overall in the last century. That's what a lot of people
say. I don't think anybody would disagree with you on that one.
Yeah.
I've ridden in those things and
it's still flying. It's still flying.
Yeah, I know it. And some of the tales from World War II, you know, they get shot all full of holes and they're still staying in the air.
Mm-hmm. Same thing as they were a C-47. That was the Air Force designation of them.
Right.
They flew the Hunt.
South Africa. Right. Mm-hmm. My uncle, who I was named for, Uncle Harry, he was a flying crew chief on one of the, Goonie birds flying the Hump. And they thought they were flying secret missions until one Japanese Zero punched a lot of holes in their airplane, and they found out it wasn't such a secret after all.
No.
But they kept on flying. Neat airplane.
Yeah, for sure.
Except you can't freebase cocaine in the back of an airplane, as Ricky Nelson found out.
Hard to do. That's what caused the fire?
That's what I've been told, yeah.
Oh, jeez. All right.
Sad end to a somewhat teen idol.
Yeah.
Anyhow, number eight. This one is really, really a find. This is the boat Kylo, K-Y-L-O-E, code name Mary. KFK-203 was her number. That's that big sailing yawl that was going back and forth from Europe to Argentina, bringing spies and radio equipment and valuables and bringing stuff back. And that's the one skippered by Captain Lieutenant Heinrich Garbers. And he got the Knight's Cross, and nobody knew who the hell was Heinrich Garbers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we dug into it and we found out, yeah, he got his Knight's Cross for flying people back, or I'm sorry, sailing people back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Borman who asked him, could he get in and out of these secret coves undetected with passengers? And he said, yeah, he's been doing it all along. And right after that, Dönitz was heard to say that they had found an impregnable Shangri-La for the Führer, which we are quite certain he meant Bariloche, and Garbers were just coming and going, and nobody bothered him. There was a TV show way back in the late 40s, early 50s, starring Jack Warden, called The Wackiest Ship in the Army, and it was a sailing ship that was manned by U.S. Army guys in the South Pacific. They were spies, agents, saboteurs, whatever. But they would dress like local fishermen and wave at the Japanese planes going by. And basically, that's what this guy did, only for real, not in the movie. Planes or ships would come look him over, and he'd wave at them. They'd wave at him. They'd be dressed like Portuguese fishermen. And he's been down there many times, down to that little place called Caleta de los Loros, which I have to go check out. I just have to go check out. Even if I have to pay for my own rental car, I got to go there.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much there. So that's what I'm going to be talking to my angel about in another few weeks.
Well, this whoever this gentleman is, and I hope he's listening, I can't even begin to thank you on behalf of the world that cares. And there's still a lot of folks out here that care very much about the truth. And you're making it possible. Okay, Harry, hold on.
Hold on.
We're going to go right through this. Let's keep going.
Whatever you say, it's your show.
Number nine.
This is a prison in this area. It's a very remote part called Tocota. I have no idea where that's at, but there was a prison out there for a guy named Eugenio Frank Langner. And we're not sure why they put him into the slammer out there, but we're digging into that.
What year? What time frame?
During the war years, but that's as much as we know right now. We're trying to get more information on it. We will get more information.
What province is that?
I don't know. That looks like it's in the middle of nowhere, so I'm guessing it's
It says just a wild Tocota, guess. T-O-C-O-T-A on the sign, so you ought to be able to look it up. Tocota, right. Argentina. Let me see if I can find it.
There you go.
While you keep talking, I'll keep
looking. Okay. The next few are basically more information, number 10, number 11, 12, and 13, are newspaper articles we've found of the day in which the Argentines are telling their people that German submarines were there. And the one number, what the heck is that number, 11? Yeah, number 11, they show a picture of a Type 9 submarine, but they're talking about U-977, which was a Type 7 submarine. But back in those days, I don't think they really cared what the type was. They just wanted to get the point out. There was a German sub there.
Okay, number 11. Number 12, same thing, a report of a...
Right.
And number 13, Submarino Alemán en Mar del Plata.
Right, the German submarine in Mar del Plata.
Yeah.
That was where the two submarines surrendered long time after the war. U-530 surrendered in late July. The war ended in May the 8th. The surrender order went out, and this was in late July. He surrendered in Mar del Plata. And 2 weeks later, U-977 also surrendered in Mar del Plata. Both said they had no idea the other one was going there. Neither one knew the other one. Neither one knew the other one's plan. But they both said that they wanted to surrender their men someplace where they would be treated with dignity. Mm-hmm. And they were immediately turned over to the U.S. Navy at that point. So who's kidding who?
Yeah, right.
And we're proving in another one of our books, which will be out shortly, that U-977 no way could have made it on the fuel it had down there. And also, in the book written by Heinz Schaefer, the skipper of U-977, he talks about his wonderful feat of traveling 66 days completely underwater for 66 days running the snorkel. And he claims that that's how he was able to conserve fuel. But of course,
no, it doesn't make sense. It takes more fuel to go underwater.
That's right. If you're running underwater with the conning tower and all those irregular shapes, your parasite drag increases. But people bought it for a long time. But now our agent down there, Michael Ivanheim, is proving that that's a bunch of horse pucky. And now we're finding our other agent, Pizarro, who is the most prolific agent we got. Pizarro is digging out files in which U-977 was in communication, radio communication, with another German U-boat down there, not U-530, because that boat had already surrendered, but this one was going on further down under Cape Horn. So we're digging into that one.
Went around the Cape or just down to the Cape?
We don't know yet, but he was on his way in the direction of the Cape.
All right. Well, Tocota, Argentina... T-O-C-O-T-A, Tocota. There is a...
Okay.
AccuWeather actually has a weather for it. And it says...
good.
It's in, I believe, San Juan province, next to La Rioja and Coquimbo. So you can find it. Valparaiso is
Valparaiso,
in the area.
Chile.
It's in the area
that'd be
there.
Chile.
Yeah.
Right, so that would be by the Andes then.
Yeah. All right, well, that's pretty barren, so it's obviously on the... the leeward side, I guess it would be, of the mountains where it's dry, not the windward side.
On the eastern side of the mountains. Yeah, it looks desolate there, real desolate.
Yeah.
Okay, now, number 14, excuse me, through number 23. This is all the remains, this is all the remains of another processing plant that belonged to the Lausen Wool Company. Remember, we talked about that, Lausen, L-A-H-O-U-S-E-N, Lausen Wool Company. Every little town in Argentina had a Lausen Wool Company where they bought wool from the sheep farmers, etc. It was also the lifeblood of the German espionage.
That's an odd place for a wool company, right? On this desolate ocean.
Well, they also got into lard rendering or whatever you want to call it, boiling down seals and whales for their oils, which
I
apparently
see.
is a high-quality motor oil.
So what are all the square concrete forms? What are that? Were those just foundations for a much larger building?
That's correct. And this whole thing is just just dilapidated, evaporated, abandoned. It's going to hell. Mm-hmm. And so we've had some people down there digging around, and you see in one of those shots, number
17, there's a marker of some kind in the ground.
Right,
it looks like a little candy cane.
Right. But number 16,
there's a seal.
That's we got divers down in the water out there too.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly what we're going to find, but we have information from our agent Michael Ivanheim that says German U-boats had been coming to this area to pick up some of the oil and also allegedly picking up fuel here. We're digging into that also.
All right. Now, you've come across a number of indications that there were several U-boats that were scuttled, sunk, and I don't know if it was Mar del Plata somewhere. You've got markers. We've done pictures. If they were to find a U-boat down there, would there be an effort to raise it and restore it, save what's left of it as a piece of war history, assuming that there were no fatalities on it?
Well, there wouldn't be. These are the two boats you're talking about in Caleta de los Loros, which is Parrot Cove.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there would be any effort to try to raise and restore it. We've seen pictures of other boats underwater, U-352 off of Cape Hatteras and various others. The salt water has not been kind. The outer skin that you know as a submarine is only an eighth of an inch thick.
Yeah, they have twin hulls. So that's gone. All right.
Right. You got a pressure hull, which looks like a giant acetylene tube down there under the water, and a tube sticking out of the top of it, which would be the pressurized part of the conning tower. But the bridge is gone, and the deck is gone. There's nothing left of it. So,
are there any U-boats anywhere that are? And I don't believe in disturbing the graves of fallen mariners, but are there any anywhere where the crew might have escaped, or most of them that are still intact enough to pull up?
Yeah. One of our members lives in Australia, kind of a wild man. he's a transplanted American, and he's a sidecar racer. So I say, I'm not sure those guys have all their marbles, but he has been working with the Turkish government, and several of the Type 2 submarines have been found in shallow water off the Turkish coast.
Mm-hmm.
There were six boats, Type 2s, that were taken out of the Baltic. They were school boats, training boats, and they were disassembled somewhat, put on barges, and sent down the Donau River, which later becomes the Danube River in Austria, and all the way down to Constanța, Romania, on the coast of the Black Sea. They were put back together, recommissioned, and the six of them were there in the, I think the 33rd U-boat flotilla. And one of them got destroyed dockside by Soviet planes. One of them was left behind, but then on the 10th of September 1944 was when the Red Army was closing in. The other four sailed across the Black Sea and pulled the plug on their boats to scuttle them close inshore to where everybody could get ashore.
Mm-hmm.
And they found, I think they found all of them, but the one we're looking at is U-20, and we've got photos of it, and it looks in pretty really good shape. Now, does somebody want to raise it?
Where is it? Where is it exactly? In which country?
It's in Turkish waters.
Okay. Well, international effort, a lot of money. The Turks might give it up. I don't know. Who knows?
Money opens a lot of doors.
My money opens all doors.
Yeah. So whether or not they want to give it up, who knows? But then we look back and look at U-534 that was raised by, a good friend of mine, Lars Petersen, was the head of the group raising it, but it was financed by a guy in Denmark. Mm-hmm. They spent a ton of money getting the thing raised, and then you got it raised, and apparently they hadn't given a whole lot of thought about where are you going to put it. It's not like your 16-foot Chris crab where you can stick it on a trailer and put it in your garage. This was 252-foot long submarine, and it bounced around and bounced around and damn near got cut up for scrap a couple times. Then finally they got over to a museum in Liverpool, the Nautilus Maritime Museum, and then that area got sold. The warehouses got turned into high buck flats, and they had to move it again, and there were a lot of liens put against it in court, and it looked like it was going to go to the scrapyard. And finally the Merseyside Transportation Company came forward. They've got, you know, the ferry across the Mersey, as you remember that song from the
mm-hmm.
70s. So they bought U-534, put it up on shore, cut it into five sections to where people could look into it, and that saved it. But unless you have all these ducks in a row, you have to have everything laid out. Otherwise, you're faced with a disaster.
Okay.
So in addition to the cost of raising it, you got to have a place to put it.
Right. Okay, hang on a second. We have to pause. We'll be right back with Harry. Half hour to go. Okay, back with Harry. All right, we're looking at photos. If you go under Harry's name and guests, you'll find them very easily. The Argentina photos, that's where we are. Okay, and next up.
Yeah, we'll start with number 24, and that goes all the rest of the way through the film clip. This is a place, I'll probably butcher the pronunciation, but it's El Sosniado. El Sosniado. Whatever that means, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
This was a lodge, I guess would be the best way to put it, way, way, way up in Mendoza province.
Uh-huh.
And this was a ski school for the military. And we've also got some photos of a very young Juan Perón in this place back when it was up and running. Now we're finding out that Perón was also there in the years just prior to the war,
mm-hmm.
and in the early days of the war to meet German spies and agents
right.
out there.
Right.
So that's another place we have to go back, and it's desolate. Man, let me tell you, it's desolate, but there has to be somebody nearby who used to work there, that we will get, we'll find them, and we'll get the story out of them. Because we're finding out now that the German influence down there was deeply embedded mm-hmm. prior to the war.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, the Argentine embassy would have to kick out one or two German officers or political guys just to pacify the U.S., but they helped them an awful lot.
I'm told that the NTSB, regarding Ricky Nelson's DC-3 crash, was the rear heater failed.
Was that what it was?
The back
okay.
of the cabin, yeah. So that's they had to rewrite their report.
The NTSB, to the best of my knowledge, is pretty straight and honest.
The
stories of the freebasing, the cocaine.
Well, maybe they were doing both. Who knows? I don't
know. Who knows?
Rock and roll. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never done that stuff. But, you know, just a sad way to end. And he was doing one-nighters.
Yeah.
Like Jerry Lee Lewis after, the world found out about his 13-year-old wife.
Mm-hmm.
He was making $10,000 a night for appearances, and after that he was doing one-nighters for $100 a night.
Yeah.
And I met him at a local honky-tonk. I used to drink back in the old days when I was driving race cars.
Uh-huh.
Lived outside Chicago. There was a place called the Manor Lounge in Stone Park. And once a month they would have big-name entertainers in there, and one time it was Jerry Lee Lewis. And during a break, he and I sat on a front fender of his stretch Lincoln and just talked about life in general. He's a pretty decent guy, an incredible talent. Just not too sharp at marrying your 13-year-old cousin.
No, and that wasn't a real slick move.
No. So anyhow, so that's what happened to Ricky Nelson's DC-3. So anyhow, El Sosnes Dora, whatever that means, that has the look of a large lodge-type place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got people in there now, and they're digging into it now. That's the nice thing about shark hunters as opposed to any of the other researchers coming out with books. They do some research. They write what they think is a good book. Or in some cases, maybe they don't think it's a good book. They just want to hear the cash register ring. We've got people all over the world. And so we've got people in Argentina who are digging into this, doing preliminary research. And they get all their ducks in a row, send me photos, send me information. And I go down there. And I can't write a book saying that Agent so-and-so says this. I can write a book saying Agent so-and-so said this, and I went down there and talked to the guy, and yes, he added this much to the story.
Well, you and I both know that if that boat skipper who grew up on the estate was there for any number of years, which he obviously was,
right,
that there are usually photographs around.
Wouldn't that be great?
Well, every family has them.
Well,
even if the man wasn't in the photographs, it doesn't matter. That would be a real bonus. But
that would be great. But who knows? Who knows? I know some of the mafia guys never liked their pictures taken.
All true.
Imagine Hitler, who was...
Well, he would not want a picture taken.
Right. He was the most hunted man in the world at that time, so I'm sure he would want to stay.
Although we have talked about that FBI, that redacted FBI letter that said that there's no reason to believe he's down there. We're calling all efforts off to try to find him. And I still think that was a canard. I think that Hoover was finally brought up to speed, taken into the inner circle, and that was the end of that.
So yeah, we made a deal to let him go, and we got all this super scientific and technological stuff.
Exactly.
The deal was, let him go, and so now we say we don't know where he is, and we don't believe he ever got down there.
Exactly.
It may surprise you, Jeff, but governments lie.
Golly.
Chucky Darn, they lie.
That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and it's incredible the amount of lies that we're fed, and, you know, most people believe what the government tells them.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I believed Hitler was a horrible monster because the government said so. I believed that he shot himself in the head because that's what the government said so. I believed in all this other stuff. And that the Stalin was a wonderful man. Churchill was a wonderful man. Roosevelt was a wonderful man. Eisenhower was a wonderful man. That's what we were taught, so that's what we believe.
Yeah, well, nothing could be further from the truth.
Exactly.
I mean, they even gave the biggest butcher in known history, Stalin, the name Uncle Joe. So it's all
yeah,
psychological
right.
stuff.
Right, and his name wasn't even Stalin.
No. Okay, we got picture number 22, which is an odd thing. Don't know what that is.
Yeah, we're trying to figure that out. That's something the guys found underwater. That's an underwater shot. I don't know. Looks like a dressmaker's dummy.
I don't know what it is. Could they not pull it up? Looks small.
Well, it looks small in the picture. Maybe it is small. I don't know. Maybe it's as gummy and gooey and nasty looking as it looks pretty crummy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd want to be grabbing that thing, whatever it is.
All right. Okay. Hold on a second. We do have to pause now. We'll be back and roll through the rest of these pictures with Harry as we continue. On a picture patrol with Harry Cooper. What number are we on now, sir? 22?
Well, we're just going 24. Well, 24? We were talking about 22, which was that weird thing in the water, which we have no idea what it is yet.
Yeah.
24 onward, which is El what I say, El Sosteado.
Yeah.
Which is the resort or lodge or whatever you want to call it, where the Argentine army was teaching skiing, because you notice they're right on the mountain there.
Mm-hmm.
And Perón was training there also. We've got some photos of him as a very young man. And it was here where he met with German agents and spies prior to the war and even in the early days of the war.
Well, the darn thing looks intact except for the roof. It looks like it could be rebuilt. They just put new timbers in it, built the inside. The exterior looks solid.
Yeah, and the wood, I'm guessing, either rotted away or termites, or because they got termites down
there. That could have been taken away, too. Burned for firewood, who knows?
Right, firewood or building homes. Because I know in Germany, any of the abandoned buildings right after the war, the abandoned buildings were stripped quickly to rebuild the homes that had been bombed.
Well, it's not exactly a tourist destination, but...
No, it sure don't.
That's pretty ugly country.
Yeah, and it's a long way from Buenos Aires, but remember, that was where they had picked it, 700 miles southwest in the little town of Bariloche. That's where Hitler's home was until 1955.
But that Bariloche was a beautiful place.
It is a beautiful place. Pretty small and desolate back in those days.
Yeah.
And like I say, 700 miles away from Buenos Aires. And there was no transportation all the way there. The hotels where he was living or being seen after the war was over, after he had moved up to Cordova, they were in nice little towns too, but they're way out in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, trying to be far, far out was what they were doing, you know.
Yeah.
Keep prying eyes away from them. And we don't know what's around this this lodge here, or El Sosna, whatever the heck. There might be a bustling little town half a mile away. We don't know. I got to get that from my people down there.
Sure.
But I'm looking forward to going there.
Okay, well, I hope the boat captain is findable. It's time for him to tell his story. Even if he tells it all in Spanish, we got translators, subtitles, you know, it's easy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, be happy to put him on camera and give him his 15 minutes of fame.
I'd give him more than that, but he's got a story. That's a story.
Yeah. It would be wonderful to find out if he had photos.
Yeah.
We asked Catalina. Well, I didn't, but one of my people asked Catalina Gamarro, the waitress who waited on Hitler and Eva Braun at the Eden Hotel, if she had any photos. And at first she said she did, and she had documents and everything, and then all of a sudden, no, she didn't have nothing.
No, she still has them. She wouldn't burn them. Somebody that old wouldn't do that, I don't think.
Probably not, but she passed away just about 6-8 months ago. So, got to find her children if she had any.
Yeah.
The problem, you know, is I'm only in country for 2 weeks, and I don't speak Spanish, and so, you know, I've got a translator, of course, but got to run all over Hell's Half Acre, and, you know, you got 40 people you want to talk to in 10 days. Get a little front.
Very good. Okay. So, overall, the book is selling extremely well, as it should. Anything from the people who have been stealing from you? Any ramifications from the plagiarists?
Right now I'm at Disney World. We're celebrating my wife's birthday, my daughter's birthday. My daughter graduated college with many honors, et cetera, et cetera. And I was standing in line to pay for something, and they give you buttons for everything. Gave my wife a button for birthday and my daughter a button for birthday and graduation. I had a button saying I was a top-selling author. And so this lady behind the counter asked me, and I told her about it, and the guy standing in line behind me says, oh, there was a TV program about that just recently. I says, oh, yeah, the book by Gordon Williams, right? He says, yeah, that's it. I says, yeah, he took about half his book from my book, which came out years before his, and my friend Abel Basti down in Argentina is suing him for plagiarism.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't heard anything from Gordon Williams. And his partner, Simon Dunstan, is real, real quiet. I don't know if he had anything to do with plagiarizing or anything, but Dunstan is real quiet, whereas we had reports about Williams that, you know, he was blowing the money that his investors gave him on ultra-high-buck hotel suites, fancy meals, and a high-priced gal from Brazil. And so they, from what we were told, they slammed the checkbook shut before he could finish everything that he needed to do. So maybe he found it easier to plagiarize. I don't know. That's not an accusation.
It's always easier to plagiarize. Come on.
Well,
why should you do the work? Goodness, you've flown halfway around the world many times, and they went down there once, I think, with a lot of money. At least one group did.
Yeah.
Fly
around the world for sure. The end of June, I'm going to be back in Germany and Austria. And July, if all goes well, I'll be in Argentina wearing my long underwear, I guess, because it's the dead of winter down there.
Okay. You'll stay warm.
Yeah. Drink a lot of wine.
And drink something. Hot chocolate.
Yeah.
Okay, so if somebody wants to go with you this time, they can't. This one
not
is
in not in July, but in September to Germany for the memorial, yes, and Argentina in January of 15, absolutely yes. We can only take a total of 10 people, otherwise it gets too cumbersome. So the information on the Argentine trip will be up on the website within about 2 or 3 weeks. But if your listeners want, they can just send me an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and say, hey, I want the information on Argentina. So as soon as I got it, I'll just send them an email and say, okay, it's posted. Here it is.
Okay,
and, of course, the book, you know, they go online there to sharkhunters.com and click under books. Bingo, there it is. $25, unless you're a Shark Hunters member, then it's only $20. And $6 to ship anywhere in the U.S. We're not shipping outside the U.S. because it's just a goat rodeo.
No, it is such a scene. I have a few products, and people want to buy them, and you have to go all the way to the downtown post office, fill out all of these forms, stand in long lines. It's just not right.
And it doesn't get there very quickly.
No.
It costs us $20 to ship the book overseas. Plus, the poor guy that bought it is calling us, you know, or emailing, where's my book? Where's my book? It's been 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Then we find out it's been sitting in customs over in their country because those people, you know, the customs officer, they don't really care. So, you know, we're looking at 4 to 6 weeks plus heavy bucks, so we just don't ship overseas. It's unfortunate. We are working with a French outfit now. They want to translate the book into French and publish it over there.
We should ask them to translate it also into German while they're doing it.
Well, one of the men I'm meeting with in
I wonder
June
if the book would be allowed in Germany.
He's a German publisher, and that's what we're going to be talking about, translating it into German and him publishing it in Germany. So it's getting, even though, you know, it's in English right now, it's still selling very well. And, we're gonna, like I say, we'll probably get it done into French. Our attorney is checking over the, contract, which is a way too much restrictive as far as I can see, restrictive against me. So we gotta loosen things up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the German, publisher. I'll be seeing him in June, and, you know, we should be rocking and rolling pretty quick.
Yeah.
I had another guy offer to translate it into Japanese, but I checked with our Far East representative, and he said publishing houses in Japan are just closing because they're not getting any business. Japanese people would rather read it on a Nook or a Kindle.
Well,
they're not interested in World War II.
Japan is dying also. There's a horrible, horrible thing going on over there because of the radiation. It's not good. Not good at all. All right, my friend. Thank you for this month. We'll talk to you next month. Bring us more information. Did you ever talk to that guy who had that weird object I was trying to chase down?
No, I know what you're talking about. I'm trying to get him to come up with a price to sell it to you, but he keeps hemming and hawing about it. Well, maybe I'll put it up for auction. Well, maybe next month. Well, maybe not now. Well, maybe.
Does he even know what it is?
No, we've come up with, you know, we asked our members, and, you know, it's like six blind guys trying to describe an elephant.
Uh-huh.
So we've had a whole bunch of guys come up with different ideas of what this thing is. I have no idea what it is. It's a neat-looking thing, but what the heck is it? What does it do? Who had it? Who used it? What was it? You know, you could sit there and go around in circles for a while and still never come up with it.
I agree. All right. Thank you, Harry. You have a good time down there. Get some rest. It's a workout, but say hello to the family for me.
Good deal. Thanks much, pal. We'll talk to you later.
Indeed. Good night. All right. That's Harry Cooper, and we'll be back in just a few with Hour 3.